Support for this podcast comes from Staffing Future. Nowadays, your recruitment website needs to do more than just validate your business. Websites are your digital front door, where new clients and great talent should come knocking. So do you want your recruitment website to stand out from the crowd, generate new business leads and placement revenue? If that's a yes, then talk to Staffing Future, the recruitment website and technology experts. Get a free website and technology stack review and competitor analysis today. Just visit staffingfuture.com/rules.
What great ideas are so close within your grasp? Seeing other points of view, anticipating change, considering multiple possible turnouts, acknowledging uncertainty, searching for compromise. We're going to talk about how to get over those limiters of innovation so that you can extract better thinking from yourself and your team. So let's talk about how to win the future.
Welcome to the Marketing Rules podcast from Thinking Circles with me, your host, James Whitelock. How do we recruit with diversity and inclusion in mind? From starting a search for potential candidates, writing the job advert, to conducting an interview, what practical things can we do and should we be considering? Joining me this week is Adam Tobias, co-founder at the Inventum Group. Adam walks us through the practical steps we need to take to make our recruiting tactics more D&I compliant. Welcome back, everybody, to the Marketing Rules podcast. And today I am joined by Adam Tobias of the Inventum Group. Adam, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, James.
So for the people out there who don't know you or don't know the Inventum Group, maybe you could kind of give us a little bit of a background about yourself and a little bit of insight into what the Inventum Group do.
Sure. Well, I've been in the recruitment industry, or staffing industry, if you like, for 25 years. So it's probably a shock for anyone who can see the video of this, my youthful good looks, but I have been around for quite a long time. We actually recently rebranded into the Inventum Group from Wells Tobias, which is a business I co-founded in 2005, full service recruitment and search firm. We had a lot of success under that brand name, but we decided it was time for a bit of a change. A lot of the work that we've been doing over the last sort of 5 or 6 years has really been within the ED&I space. So our recruiting brands, for example, our search team were providing diverse shortlists for every assignment that we worked on, and we did very similar within our recruitment space. Our processes have been inclusive for a long time, and one of the things that we found was happening was our clients were reaching out to us to say, look, we don't really understand this space. It's new. It's really important that we understand it. Well, can you come and help us? And from that spun out a consulting division, which I lead, and that's really focused on helping organisations to attract and retain diverse and underrepresented talent, and also advising them on their recruitment process, so how to ensure that the process is fair and equitable for everybody, and also just, you know, trying to break down the barriers that certain underrepresented groups face in the workplace. And that's been hugely successful in the last few years. We've been extremely busy in that space and hopefully having a positive impact.
Did you kind of, there was a point, you know, a few years ago where you saw this kind of flip, you know, because within recruitment, we've been talking about D&I for a while, but only kind of maybe, from my opinion, over in the last kind of year and a half, has it kind of suddenly come to the forefront. Now, obviously, you'd spotted this a little bit earlier. So when was that kind of point where you spotted it to becoming kind of more, I wouldn't say mainstream, because that doesn't sound right, but you know what I mean, when it became top of mind for everybody?
More topical and more important. Well, look, you know, I'm delighted it is more topical and more important. I think everybody comes to this from a different perspective. From our perspective, actually, because I think the conversation around ED&I, and I use the word E with the D&I bit, which is equity, and we can discuss that a bit later. But I guess our, you know, everyone comes from a different angle. My particular interest really spun out from sort of disability in the workplace, you know, removing barriers for disabled talent. A lot of conversation around ED&I is centered, and for really positive and good reasons, but centered around race and ethnicity and gender. You could argue the gender piece is really driven A lot of the conversations have been driven from gender pay gap reporting from 2017, which is a legal requirement for any company over 250 people. And sadly, some world events, well, maybe not sadly, importantly, some world events have really shone a spotlight, a continued spotlight on the terrible discrimination that people face, you know, from diverse or underrepresented racial or ethnic backgrounds. So really important. My personal journey was slightly different. It was really around disability. And within that space, you know, I have a particular passion for neurodiversity in the workplace. But actually, it doesn't really matter how we get there. And it is certainly a growing movement. I don't think we spotted it as a business opportunity. We spotted it as a kind of a I guess, in response to clients' requests. And it felt like doing the right thing. But we also had all the evidence to show a lot of studies out there that have been around for quite a long time, a lot of academic studies, you know, analysing some, you know, some deep analysis of empirical data to show how positive it is from a commercial perspective to build an inclusive workforce, a diverse workforce in an inclusive environment. So we just took that knowledge along with the kind of doing the right thing here and wanting to make a positive difference, combined it, and that's been really positive. You know, I'll just say that, you know, our view is to change the world one person, one company at a time. What we learn at work, we all take home with us into our friends, our society, our community, our culture. So organisations have a huge responsibility and a huge power, actually, to help educate society, if you like, on these topics.
And you must have seen, obviously, you've seen this kind of change. And where are we, you know, at this point? You know, I mean, obviously, as you said, it's much more kind of topical. Is it still just, you feel, a topic that needs discussion, or are we actually making proper progress in the direction of having a much more diverse and inclusive workforce?
I think it depends on who you ask. It depends on the experiences of those individuals. You know, there's a lot of different perspectives here. You know, someone told me long ago, and I've remembered this, you know, there's always three sides to every story, right? Your side, my side of the truth. And I think that probably exists here as well. Yes, I believe there has been progress in the sense that it is higher up on the agenda and it is more sensitive. People, organisations in particular, are more sensitive to this. We're seeing organisational structures built around this topic. We see a lot of firms hiring ED&I leaders, separated from maybe an HR function, which it might have been seen as an HR function previously. I think they're having more influence. I still think organisations are better at looking internally at their organisation when it comes to inclusion than they are about attracting and retaining diverse talent. It's never been a better time to have this conversation, but I think there's still a long way to go. You know, and it's also not going to be fixed overnight. You know, you look at the boards. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm sat here as a white middle-aged man. I appreciate that I can represent maybe a lot that's wrong. You know, and there's obviously stuff you can't see. Most diversity is invisible. But the point is, I think it really depends on who you are, what characteristics you have, whether you see this change. There's a long way to go. As a sort of a long-winded answer to quite a simple question.
No, I understand. It's a much more kind of complicated question, and actually an even more complicated answer. Now, several times you said ED&I. Okay, so what does the E stand for?
The E stands for equity. Okay. And, you know, it's something that we've started to use and to see. And there's a lot of jargon, right? And I think, you know, lots of jargon around this can be also really uninclusive. If you're not initiated, then in itself it can be, you know, so it's something that Pasha just written an article about this. But for us, we say ED&I. And in America, for example, it's more common to say DE&I. But the E stands for the same thing. It means equity. Now, equity is different from equality. Equity is about leveling the playing field, no matter what your starting point was, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Let's imagine a mental picture. We have three people standing by a fence overlooking a football stadium. They can peer into the stadium. One is tall enough to look over the fence. One is not quite tall enough to look over the fence. And one is really small, can't look over the fence. Now, if you gave each of those people a box to stand on, that would be equality. Because they're all getting the same thing. So the guy who can already see over the fence is even higher over the fence. The person who can't quite see over the fence can now see over the fence. And the little person still can't see over the fence. Right? So now we take the box from the man who's the tallest and we give it to the smallest. So he has two boxes now. Does that make sense? So you can all see over the fence now. And I think that's the point. It's actually, I'm describing a slide that I use actually in some of the work that we do when we're talking to clients, but it's about leveling the playing field. And I think the reason why we put it first is that if we level the playing field, then diversity and inclusion are much more likely to happen. Mm-hmm. Right. So it kind of sits at the very heart of this topic. And it's kind of a weird word for us, Brits, equity. I mean, that means something completely different in most of our minds.
Yeah. So, I think that you're right. That's why I kind of asked the question, because it's something I have seen kind of used, but I've never really kind of understood the kind of ethos or the meaning necessarily behind it. Obviously, one of the things we're going to kind of talk about today is making your kind of recruiting and your searching and eventually, you know, towards the end, your business more kind of inclusive. So let's talk about the recruitment process. You know, it's something that you were kind of dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And I would imagine from a company perspective who are trying to kind of, you know, hire with this in mind, from a recruiter's perspective who are trying to kind of hire with this in mind, you know, where do you start, right? How do you make your kind of process, your recruitment process, more kind of diverse and inclusive? You know, is that simple as, well, we just want more of this diverse people, or is there things you can do along the process itself that make it much easier for to kind of hire?
It's a really good question. You know, there's a few sayings out there that I think help here. Inclusion is a choice, right? Diversity is a reality. We live in an environment where there is diversity. Just like in nature, there's biodiversity in nature. But it's the inclusion, it's a choice. You know, for us, it's really about building inclusive processes. If we can build an inclusive process that doesn't discriminate intentionally or otherwise, the likelihood is we're going to remove those barriers. Now, we have to take a bit of positive action, okay? So that might be thinking about how we, for example, how we write our job adverts, right? Where we're putting those adverts, what terminology we're using, how we're even looking at the job spec, for example, and saying, is this job spec unintentionally or otherwise discriminating against certain groups? How much of this do we actually need? Because obviously, the wider we can make a requirement, the more opportunity it is to reach different types of people. So for me, process is really important. And there's a couple of things that I think we can do. Firstly, we make a commitment that we're going to make our process really inclusive. We're going to seek continued improvement. Job adverts are a really simple thing to do. Mm-hmm. There's lots of actual technology out there, some of which is free, where you can use to kind of think about how you are writing adverts for jobs. I mean, obviously, I appreciate recruitment is not just about writing adverts and hoping that people apply. There's a lot more to it than that. But that's one part of it. Where you're putting those adverts, you know, are you making a commitment on your content, on your website, on your adverts, on everything you put out that you really want to reach as many people of all characteristics as possible? You need to look at your recruitment process. So the point when people apply, right? You're just encouraging people to apply. Once they apply, what's our process? How do we interview people? You know, I would argue that an inclusive interview needs to have more than one person in it. It needs to use a competency interview approach where people are tested on their competencies, on their skills, rather than how they present themselves in the interview. That interview should be scored by individuals who then don't sit in the room afterwards and say, oh, what did you think of that person? I don't know. What did you think? Actually, go away and score it. Make it as objective as possible. They scored really highly on these competencies, and I really like this. They come back together, then they talk about it. Mm-hmm. Little thing, it does make a big difference. You know, you can do things like blind CVs or anonymous CVs, some people call them, which is when you take away the HR function, you might take away any identifiers from your name might be an identifier of your gender or your ethnicity potentially, or where you might come from, or your historical kind of cultural background. Taking all that away, taking the names of schools and universities off, that only works to a certain degree. That works great until the first interview. Now, if you haven't got inclusive processes, it's kind of irrelevant.
That anonymizing of CVs always seems to be kind of counterintuitive, because it already suggests that there's probably some bias in your process in the first place if you're having to anonymize a CV. if you're already kind of worried that someone from a certain background or with a certain name, even for instance, is applied, it would suggest that you're already thinking we may not include that person or foot person because they've got this kind of background or this kind of name. So it kind of feels kind of that there's probably already something wrong in that if you're already going down.
Well, there's a disconnect, isn't there? There's a disconnect between trust and training internally, absolutely. So the BBC, on this exact point, the BBC did an experiment on Panorama a number of years ago. And it wasn't that many years ago, but I think it was 5 or 6 years ago. And they created two CVs, very similar in terms of education, work history, exactly the same. Sent them out to 100 real jobs. One of the fake individuals was called Adam, and another was called Mohammed. Adam received 3 times as many interview requests as Mohammed, based on exactly the same criteria. So, you know, and that wasn't that long ago. So I think, you know, there is some value to it, maybe to get through the process, and maybe to highlight some existing bias, right? But it's not going to change it unless you do something about it. Unconscious bias training gets a lot of bad press, right? In and of itself, an hour's workshop is not going to change you fundamentally about who you are and what your beliefs are. But it is part of a process. Yeah. The science of bias, why giving people permission to have unconscious bias, it's not a crime. We all have it. Right? But understanding the science behind it. And you have to be mindful when you interview. You know, it can't be, you can't, there's something, you may have heard of Daniel Kahneman. He's wrote a book, very famous book called Thinking Fast and Slow. Mm-hmm. And he proposes there's two thinking styles. Fast, number one style, is very intuitive, uses a lot of bias shortcuts, stereotyping. It allows us to put our socks on, drink our tea without overthinking it. If we had to think about everything that we did, we'd be in a mess on the floor. And system two is when we're more mindful, we're more careful about how we think. And what he's proposing is often that we use system one thinking when we should be using system two thinking. And that's where bias can take place. So it's just about a bit of training, understanding a process, using a competency matrix, scoring matrix, using multiple interviews who score separately, and making a conscious decision to be more inclusive. You know, we've got to be careful about not to trip into a positive discrimination, which can happen. It is illegal to hire someone because of their gender, mm-hmm. of their race.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to know how Think in Circles can help your recruitment marketing, then visit www.thinkincircles.com. So, everything you've kind of mentioned is very focused to online. Now, I know I understand that a lot of people now, obviously, you know, majority of us do our job seeking online. But is there any place for the kind of offline? And how does that kind of play into the larger scheme, the larger thing? Because I don't know, I'm thinking that there might be certain communities that don't have access to kind of, or is sophisticated access to kind of online kind of job application, and where does that play? Because I would imagine most people these days just literally go straight onto Indeed, boom, it goes there, and that's the only place it goes.
Yeah, and there's so many jobs available at the moment that you know, people don't necessarily have a need to go anywhere else right now. But that doesn't change this process. I think you're absolutely right. There is digital discrimination, right, in the sense that if you don't necessarily have access to the internet at home, or you're not particular, maybe English isn't first language, you don't necessarily know how to put a CV together, or but you have these amazing skills that are being untapped. It's a really, really important point that you've made. I think recruiters and anyone in the front line of the staffing industry, and it is still people driven, not algorithms yet. I think we've got quite some time to go before AI is really, those human qualities and those human skills are really developed. I think it's about that, building talent pools in certain communities. It's about joining networks, partnerships. There's lots of stuff on LinkedIn, for example, where you can start to learn. Being an ally. I think there's a danger here. People feel very worried if, let's say, they're a white male, like I am. You know, that's what people see, the first thing they see. You know, they see a very handsome, bald, white man, the first thing.
And modest
as well, absolutely. So, but you know, there's a kind of a fear about bandwagon jumping. Okay, am I being inauthentic by being an ally? By trying to reach different groups? And I think we need to get over ourselves a little bit. You know, you've got to take a long, hard look at yourself if you're using this as a sales angle. Right. I really do think, you know, we've got an opportunity to do a job with purpose in recruitment. We get a bad press. I get it, right? I understand that. But we do have the opportunity to influence and change people's lives, really, by going the extra mile to help somebody who you have an intrinsic feeling is really high quality, good candidate, got a lot to offer, but may not be able to present very well. So I think being authentic, you know, joining groups, being an ally, right? Allyship is really important. And saying, look, you know, we can impact change. You know, it's just, I'm doing a job with real purpose. Now, yes, of course, recruiters often join the industry because they can make money. Mm-hmm. But I think you can make money and do good things. I think they're not mutually exclusive here. So joining networks, partnerships, learning, you know, reading up, understanding what the 9 protected characteristics are in the Equality Act, understanding what the law says, trying to encourage your clients to think differently about their requirements, open that up to as wide a talent pool as possible, speak to people, understand, be authentic and genuine. You know, people don't have to answer your questions about their own, what their diversity might be, their collection of diversities, if you like, their intersectionality. But the more you can have these open questions, conversations, the better. Ask your candidates for referrals, and not just from underrepresented groups, but from everywhere. You know, you're looking for good people. And I think it's about engagement with your customers more than anything. You know, we're at the coalface, so we have the opportunity to say to our clients, have you considered? And often they haven't. And the companies they work for do have a, you know, the leaders are saying, you know, we want to be more inclusive. But that doesn't always trickle down to line managers who tend to be the ones who are doing the recruitment. You know, they have the same day-to-day pressures. And from their point of view, I'm just going to hire what I've always hired because I know it works.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, so yeah. It goes both ways. It's not a case of, you know, just magically finding loads of people. If a group has been discriminated against in a certain industry for many years, and in case that's mainly the case, you're not just going to magic numbers up from nowhere. You know, it's systematic change over time. You know, those organisations, I'm not going to name industries, but are starting to look at the way they hire at a more junior level or an entry level. And I'm not being ageist here, it could be at any sort of level of experience of industry, but that is where we're going to see change over time and actually succession planning. So if clients want ready-made solutions, it's not always going to be possible. So they have to think differently as well.
Let's take a little bit of a deeper dive into two of the kind of areas that I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with, especially the recruiters, which is the job description and the interview. Yep. Okay, so this is the time when I suppose a lot of recruiters will kind of have this will be the first experience we're trying to kind of recruit with D&I in mind is the job advert. And you've mentioned this a couple of times.
Absolutely.
So how do you position a job advert? How do you write a job advert? A couple of times you've mentioned searching or kind of looking for competencies instead of kind of outright experience and skills. How do you write an advert with that in mind and without it being so broad that you're inundated with the wrong people instead of getting the right people?
Yeah, it's a really good question. There's not necessarily a simple answer to this. I think it really starts, well, most recruitment job adverts are written from a job description that gets sent to them by the client. So actually the job description is the first port of call, really. A lot of job descriptions will be cut and paste jobs that have been just cut and paste over years and years, and literally is years, you know, that actually no longer really, and it's become this enormous list. I mean, I've seen job descriptions that are pages long, right? Pages and pages long. So you really need to break it down and actually be challenging your client straight from the off. Okay, can I have a, you sent me a job, but can I have a conversation with you? What do you really need here? What are the skills you really, really need? Right? Let's be, and especially now, post, or current pandemic, but you know, the fundamental changes to the way we work, the future of work. What is the absolute critical aspects of this job? What are the skills that you're looking for? If someone says often you'll see an arbitrary must have 5 years experience. Okay, why must it be 5? What about 4? What about 3? How about 2? It's really pushing back at every point, getting your client to commit to understanding that actually. All they're doing is creating barriers to their employment process because there's very little talent available. And also because they're just creating a very narrow box. It's going to be discriminatory whether they intend it to be or not. Right? Or it's going to appeal to a very small group of people. So it starts with the job. But then once you've managed to do that and you've managed to get your client, really only putting in an advert what is absolutely critical, right? Think, we need to have these. And actually you've really pushed that with your client. avoiding things like jargon. You know, the amount of times, it's a real personal bugbear here, but if anyone puts Rockstar, Ninja, or Guru on any advert, it makes me want to throw up. Right? Because we're not looking for a Rockstar, Ninja, or a Guru. We're looking for a person to do a job. Yep. And these terms are really unhelpful. What if someone doesn't feel like a Rockstar? You know, and that's maybe a cultural thing, you know. So I just think it's really important that we kind of get rid of this ridiculous jargon now. It's silly. So removal of jargon, you know, be clear about what you must have, okay? You know, there's that old adage that, you know, women only apply if they meet 80%, or men apply for. It's actually those stats that you get from mostly rubbish, actually. But there is some truth in it. So putting what's really important in there and nothing else, telling the people who are looking at that advert why they should work for this organization. You know, it's not master server now. The world has changed. It has to be. It's a fair trade here. So talking about their inclusive process and policies, what's really important to them. And then you can use technology, things like gender decoders. So have I written an advert that is, you know, because there are words that are so subtly coded. Now, it doesn't necessarily have a huge impact, but it does have an impact. So we want to be able to put adverts that we want to have adverts that have really low, you know, an equal number or hardly any coded words at all. It's free software out there. There is other software out there to sort of say, you know, what language are you using? So let's say what kind of language you use can impact whether somebody has English as a first language or not. Like it's written in a certain way. So we've got to be really mindful about all of these sort of aspects. But there's a lot of free technology out there. The internet's a wonderful thing, you know, and so that'd be my first call. And then also where you're putting that effort, right? Where are you putting it? If it's just the same old job boards that you've always posted your jobs to, or do you use LinkedIn properly? Do you use this other social media? Do you try and encourage people to like and share? You know, getting third party advocacy is really, really powerful. You know, I mean, talking about being authentic.
There even, I know there are kind of specialist job boards for people with disabilities and things like that. So it kind of, why that isn't always for everyone's kind of first port of call, in all honesty. And you're right, there's lots of kind of different technology out there now that you can just stick on a website and it can. So how important is it within a job advert, do you think, then, to put something around the company itself? Or is that something that needs to be stipulated? Is that just kind of waffle? So I'm thinking, want to explain in the job advert that you are a business that it feels that it kind of ED&I is important and you have processes in place, and if you want to question them or read up on them, you can go here and here.
That's authentic. If it's genuine, like, you know, we want to, you know, we value diversity. We want to have inclusive growth. We're not perfect. I think that's the important point. It's actually being genuine. We're not perfect. We're trying to get better. But we really welcome applications from all people with all characteristics, all backgrounds. It's interesting. It brings me onto a different point here slightly, which is, it's on topic, but slightly different. But ultimately, what we're trying to achieve, we're trying to achieve a reflection, a representative workforce. So what is represented in terms of demographics externally, internally, right? And that's all well and good, but then you start to think about, well, actually, it depends where we're based. You know, if we're a London organisation, London's demographics are very different from another part of, I'm not going to name towns or cities, but other parts of the UK, or in fact, globally. So it creates a bit of a challenge. So I just think it's really, you've got to be quite careful about, because often I think what might lead to is targets, right? And we've got to be a little bit careful about that. It's about removing barriers. So like I said at the beginning, equity, everyone gets the same opportunity, and clients are realizing where they're unintentionally putting barriers up to their recruitment process and missing out on diverse talent that can bring a load of innovation and different thinking that can really benefit.
Yeah. Let's move on to the other thing that I think a lot of recruiters obviously will do a lot of, is the interview and the interview process and how you can stop yourself from making kind of silly mistakes, tripping over yourself, and just trying to make sure that you have you're a little bit more kind of honest around that kind of ED&I kind of process, and what you kind of, how you make the whole thing a bit more kind of inclusive.
I think there's an element here of trying to standardize that interview, and also being mindful of those biases that do crop up time and again in the interview process, and just trying to insert a bit of objectivity into the process. You know, most recruiters that you meet, myself, included, feel like we're great judges of character, right? But that is a, it can actually not be judged character because we've got loads of biases. We know what our clients want, and we're just going through a process and sort of, you know, basing it on gut. Mm-hmm. Now, gut can work quite well, but not really when it comes to this kind of thing. So what we're what I would suggest everyone does when they're interviewing a candidate for a particular job, either as a recruiter or as a client and end user. So if you're going to have an interview with the same people, use the same questions in the same order. Okay, first and foremost, you know, comparing apples with apples, really important. Scoring that interview based on what I say, competencies. Now, competency could be a behavioral skill. So let's say conflict resolution. You might say, can you give me an example of when you resolved a conflict? What was the situation? What did you do? What was the outcome? That would be an example of, and then you might say person showed no evidence of any conflict resolution. They showed a bit of it, which would be zero. They showed a little bit of, you know, of competency, one point, a bit more. They showed lots of competency, like 3 points. So they're fun, you've scored that. And then you make some notes. This is how the person answered that question. We've got something that's factual. Yep. We're creating some sort of evidence. It's not completely scientific, but it's a little bit more scientific than just saying, yeah, I really like that person. I don't know why, but I just really got on with them. You know, which is sort of, affinity bias. Yeah. I really like James, great guy. We went to the same university. We like the same things. Yeah, I'm definitely going to put it forward, which happens all the time, by the way. So putting science into the program. And then, for example, you might have a subject matter competence. So tell me, James, about the best, I don't know, in this software to use for a podcast, mm-hmm. and what's your experience of it? Use that as an example. But that would be a technical question. So we have a mixture of behavioural and technical questions, maybe 4 or 5 questions in an interview. And then you've actually got some evidence, right? You've got some evidence of people's ability. Now, me personally, I have no issue with sending these questions to candidates in advance of an interview. Right? Mm-hmm. That means that everyone's got the same chance to research and prepare, and we get the best answers. Because some people don't perform great in an interview. But then their job is not interviewing. Their job is doing the job, right? You know, so often, the skill of interviewing is unrelated to someone's ability to do a certain job. I mean, I'm good at interviews. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean I could do half the job. I could probably get to second round on most interviews, right? But it doesn't mean I could do the job. I think that's, so we're just trying to put a bit of science in it. Structure, process, use a score, right? And then use that. And then it takes away things like those biases, that affinity bias or that confirmation bias, or something called halo effect, where let's say someone went to Cambridge or Oxford and we can't get our mind, you know, we just focus on that one thing, they're amazing, disregarding all maybe things they're not suitable. Or on the flip side of that, horns effect, where you see one thing you don't like and you just can't get rid of that in your mind and you don't score that candidate. So it's about putting science and objectivity to the process.
And do you kind of need to overtly ask up front the candidate when they're coming in for an interview or they're doing an interview, whichever it's online or in face, if they have any special needs of some kind? Is that something now that we should just all be doing?
Yeah.
I'm very aware that the word special needs probably is the wrong kind of term to use.
Well, I get your point. I would use, you know, do you need any adjustment in the interview process? Yeah. I think, yeah, absolutely. I don't think that's a problem. Now, people don't feel comfortable answering it, they won't answer it. If they do feel comfortable answering it, and they do, they will tell you. You know, I mean, we're talking specifically around sort of disability here, or even neurodiversity, which is sort of, you know, subcategory of, in some ways, it could be considered to be diversity of thought. But I think that's really important, you know, because you're giving that person the opportunity to shine. They might say, yeah, actually, I need a little bit more time, or it'd be really helpful for me to get a sense of who the people are that I'm meeting. You know, but actually, just having some of this knowledge as well. And we've got to be careful, by the way, about collecting data. Mm-hmm. And personalizing that data and making assumptions based on that data. Like whenever I say to clients, when you collect diversity data, it's got nothing to do with someone's application. Keep it totally separate. But asking if they need adjustments is totally fine.
Yeah. Adam, we have kind of come to the end of our kind of episode for today. But I mean, it's been absolutely amazing. It's been amazing hearing from you and your business and having kind of just taking us through some of these kind of little great kind of tips and your own experience on how to make the recruitment process much more kind of diverse and inclusive. So what we'll do is we'll include all of your details in the show notes. So if anybody wants to kind of know more about this, we can get in contact. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the Marketing Rules podcast on Apple, Spotify, and all other major podcasting platforms. I've been your host, James Whitelock, and I hope you can join me and more amazing guests next time. The Marketing Rules podcast is a Think in Circles production.